Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us again. I have Peter. Peter, thank you.
Hey, Daniel.
Hey. So we've been talking a lot. There's a lot of stuff that's going on. Institution, education has been a common theme. And the basis of education, the erosion of trust, I would say, in institutional structures. We're talking, you know, government structures, NGOs, the education system as a whole, right? I think there's generally an erosion of trust that's not conducive to continuing to scale our society, or at least in continuing to do it in any meaningful way. So what I thought we might do is just have an open discussion about how do we rebuild trust in society? And I know that the World Economic Forum has put together some kind of compilation about restoring trust as far as they're concerned. And I'm not quite sure you and I would agree with what they're proposing.
To put it mildly.
You know, maybe we could start there, Peter. What do you think?
So I think the elites are starting, quote unquote, elites are starting to get the message that we, the lowly peasants of the world, are very displeased with the way things are going. As we were talking about before we went on air, I recently saw some clips of their latest get-together where they were discussing this matter, specifically how do we restore trust, not in anything else other than how do we restore trust in the elites. And they were quite blatant and overt by using that term themselves. So this isn't how do we rebuild the relationship that the governing bodies have with the people and address the many wrongs that have been committed in the last, say, 8, 9, 10 years. No, it's how do we deceive people into trusting us again so that we can continue to essentially rule by fiat from behind the scenes. This is what's going on at all levels, right? At all politics in the U.S., you know, forget the national politics. The money is easy to fund, to travel there or to trace. Start looking at what's going on at the local, you know, city state level. How many of our DAs took outside money and ended up having these laissez-faire attitudes towards crime where if you shoplift under $900, you don't get prosecuted, right? And similar so-called nuisance crimes that have ended up contributing to real world impacts of things like, oh, I don't know, all the pharmacies leaving any areas because it's an unsustainable economic situation for them when they lose thousands of dollars a day to shoplifting. Why would you trust anybody given this climate? How do they rebuild trust? By doing what they're supposed to. So they're supposed to allow the police to enforce the existing laws against these sorts of crimes, the DAs to prosecute them, the courts to try them, and if necessary, convict them. And this isn't happening. Why? Because of the outside influence of money from these WEF elites in areas which they should not be meddling. I think we as a people globally, because this isn't just a U.S. phenomenon, they're doing it everywhere. The U.S., higher stakes because of the money involved across the board in this economy. Start challenging everybody at every level in a proper, respectful manner to see, hey, I understand, Mr. School Board Member, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Town Manager, your job is tough. Got it. You have been hired or elected by the people, given whatever the case may be, to do X, Y, and Z. Why aren't you doing it? And then at that point, weigh their answers and act accordingly when it comes time to vote or fund or whatever it's going to be. One thing that, again, we discussed offline that I sent you was an example of this undisguised class warfare that's happening in Boston. Small battle, but I think it's illustrative of the point. Mm-hmm. There's an extremely leftist do-nothing mayor named Michelle Wu for the city of Boston here in Massachusetts, where I live. And she recently announced that there would be a program of free museum passes for Boston students. That's great. But they can only this program can only be taken advantage of by public schools, not charter schools, not parochial schools. So in other words, only the institutions run by the teachers' union that adhere to the philosophy that is most pleasing to the current regime. So, you know, one may argue, who cares? It's just a couple of bucks to go to a museum. I'll pay for my kid. Yeah, but if you're a taxpayer of the city of Boston in the state of Massachusetts, you're being disenfranchised because you elect to pursue a different educational path for your child rather than what is the government-approved indoctrination path, in my opinion. You know, luckily, as we discussed, my kids are adults. I don't need to worry about this anymore, at least as far as they're concerned. I do worry about this for my compatriots. And, you know, at some point, you know, God willing, I'll have grandchildren. Well, I want them to avail of the situation, the best education possible. And how can that be when we have this undisguised class warfare that's going on? You know, I don't live in Boston, but if I did, I would make sure to agitate appropriately in the coming elections. So
yeah, for sure. I'll
turn it back to you.
Yeah, there's a couple thoughts that I have here. One, I think, I mean, I could take this a few different ways. All right. So the pharmacy question is interesting, and it makes sense. Economically, it makes sense to you and I. You know, if you have more losses than you have income, then it's not a sustainable business model. And since money doesn't grow on trees, unfortunately, at least not directly, we have to, like, there's some degree of accountability there, right? So if the community, and I think what needs to happen in those scenarios, well, we ought to understand why that's happening. Why is theft higher in some areas than others?
Yeah.
And I heard I saw a clip the other day about I forget exactly who it was. I apologize, but basically they were advocating to legalize certain crimes because it was a cultural thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's like the most terrible recursive argument that I've ever heard. It's completely asinine.
And, right.
You know, like, let's do something that's in the best interest of society. I mean, I immediately went back to like, okay, well, if slavery's white culture, according to the same theory, then
which,
like,
still exists, and we don't want to talk about
exactly.
It. Yeah.
Okay, then should we just legalize that because it's like, is that immediately make it acceptable? The answer is obviously no.
Yeah.
So, come on, you know, like, why don't we get to the root of the problem? Why does this happen? Okay, but, so
I think this is the key point. Why does the argument come up? It shouldn't.
Right.
Yeah. Theoretically, we're a society of laws, and theoretically, we still abide by the Constitution of the Republic, which says all are equal before the law. Well, why is somebody allowed to commit a crime and somebody else isn't? You know, traditionally, you know, it's a facet of wealth and power where if you are sufficiently well-connected, insulated, either politically, socially, or economically, you know, you get to play by a different set of rules.
For sure. For sure.
But now what's happening is that the agents of those who are so connected have now decided, okay, to foster discord, it's much more suitable to our agenda to decide we're not going to enforce property crimes that are under $900. Tell that to the corner sub shop owner where $900 is his payroll for the week to keep his employees hired, right? Exactly. So when he shuts his doors and, you know, however many people now are on the streets without jobs when previously they had, what's the spiraling effect on that on the second, third, fourth order consequences because somebody elected to ignore the law that has been passed, accepted, and promulgated to the society at large? And this isn't esoteric. We're talking basic stuff, right? You know, I work hard. You can't steal my stuff. That's wrong. You should be prosecuted and jailed for it.
There's a very pervasive pattern of behavior there, right? And you make a good point. These things have cascading effect. So if one sub shop closes, then there's going to be an effect to the people who work there, to the people who used to eat there,
Yeah.
Right. And we know, like, you and I frequent many restaurants, and right. you touched on something else. And it is kind of like this elitist attitude, right? That all are equal. There used to be like, and trust me, I've lived in an area where there's a lot of rich people, and they would do what rich people typically do, which is anything for their kids. And if they get in trouble, they just try to talk their way out of it, or, you know, politicize or buy them out or whatever, make a donation that's large enough or whatever it is. And I'm like, I told my kids, and I tell them the same thing my dad told me, you know, it's like, if you ever go to jail, you better not call me, because if I pick you up, I'm going to whoop your ass, you know? And guess who has yet to go to jail, and I hope to never? Me, you know?
Victory achieved.
I believed him, though. I believed him. But, you know, like, even with my kids, I'd always say, like, you know, like, they know that I would hold them more accountable than any outside organization would hold them accountable.
Yeah. You know? As I think is the true for any sane family, right?
Mm-hmm. There's something there, but I bring that up because I think it comes back to the subversion of that law of the structure of law, right? So the rule of law, the equal that we're all equal before the law, specifically. Yeah. Sorry. So when we talked about the let's go back to that corner store. Right. Yeah. So what happens? What really happens there? I think that one problem, it's cultural. The other problem, it's educational, right? But the cultural problem, it's like you can't steal from yourself forever. There's honor among thieves. So that doesn't add up. Why is there honor among thieves? Because it's not a unending enterprise. And if you steal from each other, then there's no trust. And then there's no, like, there's nothing to gain there. Right. So
it all falls apart. Right.
Exactly. It's very limited. It's very limited. I think anybody could see that. Right. But on the other side of it, it's more unlimited in a positive way. And that is, people can get a job. They can come pay for what they want in a free market, and they can work. And well, if they have skills, and you and I have talked about this, equal education should be a thing. It should be a thing. And, you know, I was actually thinking about something as you were talking earlier. You know how we have the Fed, and the Fed is decentralized from the government, and officials are elected, but theoretically, but let's just, you know, hear me out. They're at least elected on term basis that exceed the term basis of the people who elect them. Right. Yeah.
So, and that is not by accident.
No, it can't be by accident. Otherwise, we would just be, you know, doing the same thing that we do in politics all the time. So why don't we do the same for the Department of Education? I mean, the Fed's there for monetary policy. And the DOE is like, it's an absolute mess. And I think we can see that and how it manifests itself throughout all the public schools in the United States. And I think that there should be some degree of uniform, universal structure that, you know, is adhered to, but I don't think it needs to be, you know, it's more like the syllabus, but the details of the syllabus are filled in at the state and local level. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think many people would argue that's the way it was once upon a time. And then maybe 15-ish years ago, things started changing for the worse. I think it's longer than that, you know, based on
what why do you think that? I think that's because, back to that elitist approach, it's like, we think we know what we're doing better than has been done before.
Right.
Right. And you and I know from professional experience and personal experience, change is difficult to implement well, and it's difficult to implement successfully. At scale, it's incredibly difficult. So imagine, you know, just anybody who's ever worked in technology, if you're doing a phone system upgrade for 25,000 or 100,000 users, like if you're doing it for 25 users, okay, yeah, you know, we can have a plan and it can still go sideways, but it takes a different approach to do to do something at that scale. So there's something there, right? And it goes back to the centralization of control. Yeah. So, you know, if we tie that back to the original question, which is how do we rebuild trust in organizations? Well, you and I have been beating up education lately, and I think for good reason. And it's not like we're beating up the teachers per se, but I think we're focused on the wrong stuff, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Why are we focused on the wrong stuff? We can't let elected officials who get in terms for 2 or 4 years, 6 years or whatever it is, have ultimate reign and control over this country forever and ever and ever, especially about the well-being of children who are going to be participating in global economic situations.
right? Yeah. It's about development of capability of mind and then of skill, right? So it's like we start from the lowest foundation, and we build them up as such that they are capable of thinking for themselves. And then we teach them the specific skills, and we do that along the way. There have been I've read studies, I've watched videos of these schools where they're doing even more entrepreneurial style,
yeah.
Where the kids teach themselves. The kids are given a framework, and they're expected, and there's someone who will oversee the class, but they're really there to answer questions, and the kids are figuring it out more so than not. What happens when you adopt responsibility from a young age?
Yeah,
and you actually have to start figuring stuff out.
But see, you know? I think this is the crux of it, because if you look, these are what I would consider to be successful examples of education, right? It's done at the grassroots. It yes. isn't done from a top-down approach. It isn't relying on any kind of central authority. I would hazard a guess that those who are economically able to do so will pull their children from whatever public institutions exist, and they'd place them in, you know, more performant private institutions, right?
Yeah.
I think this has to be our model. We have to stop expecting that the government is there for anything else other than to shake us down economically to try and keep us in a certain place so that we are more easily controlled. There is no trust in government anymore. There is no trust in their institutions, regardless as to whether or not the individuals within those institutions may or may not be trustworthy. They are still subject to the whims of whoever their boss might be. And more often than not, it's an unelected appointed official who may or may not be on the payroll for somebody else. And even when they aren't so obviously manipulated, are they themselves a product of the indoctrination pipeline so that they are just another cog in the machine of mediocrity that has been destroying us, you know, for 25, 30 years easily? I think people have to wake up and understand that there is an agenda being propagated, and absolutely enacted at all levels of our society. Unless you are purely in a for-profit enterprise, you're subject to this. You have to understand it, mm-hmm. and you have to adapt for it, both personally and, you know, if you have a family, for the other members for whom you're responsible.
The appointed official thing. You know, that's an interesting point. And you hit on a few things, the erosion of trust, that there is no trust in a lot of these institutions, if any. And I agree with you. And I'm not sure that the lack of trust is warranted, I believe, given, you know, you could look at it one way. It's a tremendous amount of change that's been shoved down people's throats. And is it for the better? And the answer is apparently not.
Right.
It's not better to, you know, teach people how to be indoctrinated more than it is to teach them how to learn. We have the Google generation. It's like, I don't need to learn anything. I can just look it up. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. But, you know, what if Google's woke too? You know, who knows, right? So,
Hey, shall we talk about the Bard image generation then? Which they've shut down as of today.
Yeah, I've noticed. I saw that.
February 22nd, 2024.
I was laughing, yeah. But It's interesting, right? I mean, you see this, and you have companies that are huge and have a lot of control over a lot of people in this domain. But I think, you know, at least that got called out for what it was. And we should want it to be honest. That's what we should want it to be truthful, you know?
Let's do a diversion to that, right?
Yeah,
sure. Talk about control and the tech overlords, et cetera, right?
Yeah. It goes into the trust conversation for sure.
Right. So how did that get called out? Well, everybody got on Twitter and started mocking it, right? And mm-hmm. it was funny because that's where I found out about how, you know, ridiculous it all was. Because, you know, like most people, I have to earn a living, so I don't have time to be playing around with AI, right? Okay, what would have happened, you know, say 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago, whenever it was, if Twitter was still not run by Elon Musk, would this have been allowed to be posted on the platform that, mm-hmm. hey, look at this woke nonsense that Google's spitting out, where we have, you know, African-looking officers when the prompt is, show me a 1943 German officer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think our friends in the Third Reich would probably say, yeah, that's not historically accurate. And now, you know, funny, you know, snide little comment. I get it.
Yeah.
But now, again, extrapolate that on the whole trust discussion. If they're showing you that as a historical representation on literally the quote, show me a member of the 1943 German army, right? Or a 1943 German soldier. And that comes up. At what point, when our increasingly intellectually lazy generations stop thinking for themselves and they're doing their reports and they say, okay, show me that. I saw another one. Show me Vikings. Same thing. Everything except, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes. Okay.
Right.
So, I saw that at what point do people wake up and realize it's literally rewriting history?
Show me a redheaded woman. I saw that one too.
Yeah. Right. nobody would have, you know, brought this, and Google would still be running this had they not been publicly humiliated on Twitter by everybody who was doing
it. You got to tell me they didn't test this internally. Come on. Come on. You know,
like, I wonder, right? Yeah. I seriously wonder, and I wonder what the test plans looked like, who was responsible for them, and who was adjudicating the results of said test plans.
You know, the test plan, it's quite simple. It's like, show me a black person, show me a white person, show me a penis. You know what I mean?
Clearly.
Clearly.
Yeah. Nobody stopped to think, well, you know, historically accurate. You know, sub-Saharan people didn't have blonde hair, blue eyes, right?
Right.
You know, didn't work that way.
Maybe in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. Maybe now. But, you know, when you start talking about, you know, Rome 50 BC, you know, not so much.
That's great. I agree with you. I'm not sure that it would have reached the scale that it has. The other thing that I saw earlier, and this goes back to trust and just general, it's an odd world that we live in now. Okay. Yeah,
very odd.
That's what I'm going to say. Now, there was a post on Twitter X earlier. It was trending. It said that people were arguing whether or not Russia defeated the Germans in World War II. And I was like, well, I don't know if we could say that they defeated the Germans unilaterally. They certainly did not. They lost a significant amount of their male population defending Moscow against German invasion. And the Germans pretty much lost to a lack of supply lines in the far eastern front in Moscow because of very cold weather, which is Moscow's natural ally.
Yeah, and because the Russians made them pay for every freaking inch of territory they took.
Exactly.
Delaying them into the winter, and, you know, then the frigid cold helped their cause, right?
Exactly. And there's a lot that goes into that. This is not a simple answer, right? But the answer is, at the end of the day, the Russians did push them back through a bunch of tedious stuff. The Germans overextended going after the Russians, had to capitulate much of France pretty rapidly to the Allies once they were able to take both beaches and converge in the center of France and unify with the British and the American forces. Which was treacherous in and of itself. If you go, I mean, here's a little history for you, right? If you go back into the war, I mean, these guys had hedges set up, and it's like farm, huge fields with hedges, and the Germans were embedded and encamped in these fields, and they were just cutting people down left and right. Like, this is like very raw, like in the way that they broke through that. This is my piece of history for the podcast today. The Allied commanders in the region had gotten together and basically said, look, we're going to just bomb the absolute heck out of this, like, 10 or 20 mile stretch of fields to cut the Germans out so we can actually drive our tanks and vehicles through it and not get cut down after every corner that we turn. So they bombed the heck out of it for 2 or 3 days, and after which it was very easy for them to traverse, and then they were able to unify their forces. But and that's war, and that's unfortunate, and here we are. But what's the alternative? You know what I mean? So you had so let's just finish this segment out. So the Allies are coming from the West and France and Southern Italy and pretty from every direction west of Germany, basically west and northwest and south of Germany. And the Russians are coming from the East, and eventually we end up fighting and splitting the territory in Germany as the Third Reich regime is collapsing, which is when you ended up with East and West Berlin, for example. Yeah. That's why. So short answer is, Russia wouldn't have defeated them by themselves. They did hold them out of Moscow, and the Allies were doing good enough in France and other regions after the initial landings. That,
yeah, but I think part of the lies of rewriting history is to minimize the Russian contribution to it. The Allies wouldn't have beat them by themselves either. Hitler committed the insane act of trying to do a two-front war, and, you know,
We know this in economics. It's very poor. Like, you have limited resources. You need to focus on the thing that you can be best at, right? And trying to start a new front while you're defending another is not an intelligent operation. Well, and the United States was fighting in the Pacific as well at the same time, because the Japanese had engaged us in Pearl Harbor. So it doesn't mean that it's easy at all. And I don't know what the Japanese were smoking that day, but it was probably a bad idea for them. But, you know, we got PlayStation now, so it worked out.
But, you know, I think it goes a long way, too, to the trust argument, right?
Exactly.
Because if you dig into it, and, you know, I'm a big history buff, both command staffs of the Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany told their respective dictators, this is a bad idea, we shouldn't do this. And said dictators didn't trust, you know, the solid advice strategically they were getting from people whose business it was to know this. And the ultimate, you know, result was their downfall. And I think this is what we're facing now in a different way. I won't say it's a less bloody way, but it's different. The trust is shattered across the board at all levels, from the top going down and from the bottom going up. I think it's a reflection of the poor quality of people we have who enter public life, barring certain notable examples. But, you know, come on, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, are these leaders? No. You know, they're jokes, but they're entrenched because of the amount of money they can generate and because of how willing they are to do the bidding of their masters.
That's it. If you can bring money into the party, then they're going to put you up and you're going to be fronted. It's no different than getting into a pyramid scheme almost. Like, if you can bring customers and they're willing to pay, man, like, we'll keep you in place and you'll be able to retain your portion.
What I think a better analogy is, because it's far more apt, it's organized crime. Yeah. Because if you look at the history of organized crime in the U.S., and I'm sure the same would apply globally, everything runs smoothly as long as everybody's kicking up tribute to the boss, and the boss is smart enough to let everybody have a little piece in the same. And as long as that, you know, loop of corruption keeps going, it's all well and good. How different is that from our politics right now? I leave it to the listener to answer that question. I personally see no difference, other than, you know, the mafia guys dress better than our politicians.
Yeah, I'm looking. It's funny because I was looking at the corruption index before the show, just because I was curious, you know, like to see where we plot out again. So the United States is ranked number 24 with a score of 69. So that's, could be better, could be worse. Bottom of the list, you might be surprised, would be Somalia and then Venezuela. So anyway,
even that corruption index, that's overt old school corruption of.
That's the obvious.
You want a driver's license? Pay me.
I know.
Right.
You want to get the goods in the country? Pay me. You know.
Yeah.
Like, we've all been there. We've seen the line items. Oh my gosh, you used to have line items for budgets and some of these big companies, you know, it'd be like, here's the capture budget. Wait, we can't call it that. All right.
Yeah.
Something else. Let's get a more creative name, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if it's well known, but it's a known thing that if you're doing business globally at a large level, you know, they don't call it that, but there's a bribe fund because it's known that if you were dealing with certain countries, bribes are expected.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I took a program at Harvard Business School many years ago, and this was a topic of discussion for at least 30 minutes in this part of the program. This is, it is legitimate. And I know this from personal experience. It's like, some companies can magically get your imports into certain countries faster than others. I wonder why.
Yeah.
It's going to cost you an extra $500, but you'll get approved tomorrow. You know, it's like, okay, whatever. But then you're part of the problem, you know? But what is the actual problem there? Yeah, there's no trust, right? So
I think that's a key point, because having dealt with certain Eastern European countries and talking to the people, not the officials in charge.
Right.
You know, I'd say, why do you tolerate this stuff? Well, because the government doesn't work. The only way we get anything done is by, you know, passing a couple of bucks to the guy who's doing my driver's license renewal.
Exactly.
Other than that, I'd wait 2 years to get it if I just played by the rules.
Yep.
Okay. That's a problem with your system. It isn't a problem with the people who are forced to live under that system.
Right. It's quite similar in India. I've done a lot of business in India.
It's a lot of places.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It absolutely is. I mean, in our – and you make a great point, you know, corruption index being more overt. The state of corruption, as you've alluded to, and the diminishing trust in the United – like in organization systems in the United States, it's what you don't see. You don't see the actions, but you see the results. Right. So right. we start to see the results. We've been kind of living this. We see it. Why does this happen? You know, we can go back to the previous conversation. Why is Walgreens closing in XYZ neighborhood? Well, because they can't make money, because there's no trust that people aren't going to take everything off the shelves. Right. Well, so, I mean,
I'll tell you something that gets played in this that I found very distasteful.
Yeah.
So there was an example of this recently in Boston, where one of the neighborhoods lost the only Walgreens specifically.
Yep.
And I think like a 1 mile radius, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in a dense urban area where everybody –
if you're walking, it's something.
Oh, where, you know, everybody basically either walks everywhere or takes a public transit. That's a serious out of the way trip to go get, you know, your diabetes medicine, right? And unsurprisingly, the powers that be put on the irate, local residents, and they're saying, well, you know, why is Walgreens putting profits over people? No, they're not, right?
You're framing the argument the wrong way.
That's my point. It should be, why is this happening? Well, you know, the stores are getting ripped off daily for thousands of dollars. There's no way they can run it. Well, why aren't our politicians letting the police arrest these people? Because the police, I assure you, know what's going on, and it's not like they're ignoring it. I mean, you know, reputation aside, Boston cops are not that, you know, corrupt and inefficient. They want to arrest these guys. They know what's going on. But the DA tells them, yeah, you can arrest them, and I'm going to turn them loose because I'm not going to prosecute anything under $900. San Francisco, it's the same thing. Well, why is nobody calling out the DAs and everybody else associated with the political structure that's preventing the legal structure from functioning as designed?
Yes. And what happens when you tell your opponent in chess what moves you're willing to make and which ones you're not going to?
Precisely.
You're going to do anything you can get away with up to the amount you can get away with, right?
Yeah.
And it's that simple. And it's no different in war. It's no different in geopolitics, foreign policy, right? It doesn't matter what the topic is. It's just a pretty poor strategy. I wonder. Yeah, I really wonder, man. Like, what's the benefit? What could they do? I mean, is the government going to subsidize Walgreens? It's like, what sense does that make? Yeah. It makes about as much sense as not prosecuting people who are stealing. I know in the areas where we live here, I mean, I see police at the front of the Target or whatever, you know, drive by, and there's police there. I'm like, shoplifting. You know what right. I mean? Like,
yeah.
Come on, man. Like, what are you doing? If you need something, ask. I feel like we've become very disconnected from each other. And I think
it's a huge part of the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we're disconnected from each other in a real way. Right. And the human connection and that willingness to participate in something and to remember that we are participants in something that is built before any of us were born.
Yeah.
And we get to carry it forward in the best way that we can see fit, as such that it continues to be stable and structurally sound. And we don't do that by ignoring problems, and we don't do that by not talking about them. certainly. And we don't do that by pretending like they don't exist.
Yeah.
So it's like if the kid is behaving poorly, you call out the behavior, you explain why that's bad, and then you hold them accountable for their actions, you know? And in public policy, it's don't do this because it's stupid and it's enabling behavior.
Right.
I saw another clip, and I didn't believe it at first, where people were like going up north to like New York and Massachusetts and other states like this to steal, and then going back down to Florida because
it's cheaper.
It's cheaper to live, you know? Yeah. It makes sense. Well, what's the difference between Florida and these northern states? Florida will prosecute you if you steal. Therefore, it's not a good risk reward for that endeavor, you know?
Yeah.
So the cost of doing business, if you will, is too high in Florida when it comes to stealing.
You know, I saw something similar in the 90s when I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, again, big problem with illegal immigration in California in general. And there were people who would get on the bus in San Diego, go all the way up to San Francisco, say, yep, I'm homeless, I need benefits, get, you know, benefits, and then head back to San Diego for a month and then come up once a month to repeat it. Why was that? San Francisco has the highest welfare payout in the United States. And all of these people who were doing it were largely, you know, beach bums living La Dolce Vita on, you know, the sunny shores of La Jolla in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And, you know, would go do their shopping trip once a month to get all their supplies. Basically is how it worked out. And, you know, it wasn't just the illegal immigrants. It was, you know, the permanent scumbag underclass that America seems to have developed natively without any help from other countries that all knew about this cycle. And it's very similar to the Florida example you gave. I mean, yes. I can't believe it was allowed to continue because everybody knew what was going on. But again, 90s tech boom, there was so much money floating around. Nobody cared. And they figured, there's plenty to go around. What's it matter?
It was like the HELOCs and
or the
refinancing in California, because the market, the real estate market's so expensive there that you can get loans outside the range of standard Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac range. Yeah. And people were like refinancing their houses and pulling out $5, $6, $7 million and
it was insane.
Gutting the houses and just driving away with the money. You know, and it happens so much that, you know, the first question you get asked if you take out a home equity line of credit loan or something is like, is this property in California? You know,
Well, I'll tell you, even, you know, when I was out there, I mean, I was there from 92 to 2000, 2001, right?
Yeah.
I at one point I was looking to rent an apartment and I go down to San Jose and they're like, oh yeah, it's in back. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So I thought it was the main house. No, you go to the back. They had converted a 12x20 shed into an apartment and wanted to rent it for $1,800 a month in like 1997.
Yeah, imagine
and I'm that. Just like, how is this allowed to happen? Right. Again, greed fueled insanity. And it's even worse now in the intervening 20 odd years since I left.
Crazy. I see jobs posted in the Bay Area, you know, San Jose, Palo Alto, San Francisco. Oh, $350,000-$400,000, you know.
I'm yeah.
Like, all right, that sounds great, but meanwhile, it costs $8,000 to get a place that's, you know, within an hour drive. So what are you going to do?
Starter homes are 1.2 for crying out loud. I mean,
I know. Yeah. And we're talking starter homes. It's like 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom, you know.
That needs a ton of work and, you know, hopefully isn't cracked on the foundation from earthquakes, right? It's insanity.
Those are popular.
But, you know, what I don't understand about all of this is even when I was going through it personally, then I said, there's no way this is going to last. It's got to come falling down. Yeah, 25 years later, it's still going. So I'm even more fearful now because that virus has spread to the country as a whole. So at what point does this financial house of cards we've built up come crashing down? 2008 did nothing. They just slapped a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound and hoped it was going to, you know, wait until they were out of office before it metastasized. Yeah, well, I think we're there now. And if it doesn't blow up, then I don't know anymore. I give up. All logic has left the system.
What about You know, I've thought about that too, because even with monetary policy and the amount of inflation that we've seen and the current upward trend of the consumer price index, which I think many of us feel.
Oh yeah.
It's crazy. And I don't think that can be ignored either, but it's like, so who controls that? You know, and it all plays into the same picture. And you're talking about, well, one thing about the whole San Francisco thing, there's a lot of tech buildup in the greater Austin area in Texas, and benefit of Texas is it's a large land mass. And, you know,
right. There's a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. So it could be an alternative. I think it's becoming an alternative to that, to the Bay Area in a lot of ways. But I think the stuff with Elon and the state of Delaware a few weeks ago also probably is going to help the mass transition of many tech industries to that region. Not all of them, but many. I don't want to comment on that on this episode, but it does kind of play into the whole trust thing, because the trust is that you can set something up and you can do something, and someone comes in and tells you that you're doing it wrong and you can't do that.
Right.
But so again, I think it's I will comment on it. It's the overstepping of government into bounds of which were
priorly
negotiated among shareholders, right? So
let's talk about our favorite orange political candidate, right?
Yes.
So okay, this week. You know, he got handed a defeat in the courts, and I was very bemused by some of the reactions where, you know, the typical rabid left-wingers, come up and it's well overdue, et cetera. Whereas anybody who knows anything about business said, wait a minute, this judge is out of his freaking mind what he just did. It's going to absolutely put a damper on anybody wanting to do any meaningful business in the state of New York henceforth. How are you going to
precedent's been set at the highest level. That's worth paying attention to.
Right. Because now the only way this gets undone is if it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And, you know, going back to the trust issue, even if it was decided reputably and on the merits of the case, et cetera, one way or the other, nobody's going to believe it because of how politicized the Supreme Court has become, again, probably since, you know, the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. So these incremental bits of eroding trust at all levels are coming home to roost. We are in a very precarious societal position. And I wonder how many people truly appreciate what a knife's edge we're dancing on with all of these things coming together. Too many people want to have a glib response and say, ah, screw Trump, you know, he deserves it. Yeah, maybe he does. I mean, I'm not a big fan, but at the end of the day, the law is supposed to be the law applied blindly, not by appointed judges who have their own ideology and agenda to pursue.
I think you just hit it. You said essentially what you're alluding to is the over politicization of many institutions within our governmental structure. And the fact that we're so far opposed to each other in a lot of the viewpoints that we're willing to come out and discuss, I think lends itself to some of the fundamental trust issues that we have, because on one side, right. I think that kind of is the root of it. So the depoliticization of core structures that underlie the fabric of our society, of the Republic, of the departments of education, et cetera, whatever it may be, that there's something there. I firmly believe there's something there.
Well, you know, let me give an example to the counter, to the positive, right?
Yes.
So when do structures function, right? So, you know, look at any local government, okay? If you get assessed a fine for whatever it's going to be, because we all get hit with fines one thing or another, right? Whether it's traffic tickets or you forgot to pull a permit before you redid your porch, whatever, okay?
Didn't do your registration.
Whatever, right?
That's my
There's favorite. A set process where you go down and you see the nice lady that works at the town collector's office and you say, hey, I got this notice. What do I do? Honey, you got to give me $100 fine and then it's over with. And I'll get my paper and I'm clear. Right. Yeah. Okay. You pay the fine. There's no incentive for her to ask for a bribe because she has a nice job that she gets to 8 to 4 every day with defined benefits, with a pension, a predictable salary, and she can plan her life around it. Right. What is the incentive for this person to risk all of that to, you know, best case lose the job, worst case be criminally prosecuted, by shaking you down for a $50 fine to make your $100 ticket go away, or a $50 bribe to make your $100 fine go away. It's not there, right?
Right.
We have decided as a society, no, we're going to value the job that these employees perform in the interest of the public good in such a way that they are not incentivized to do that which is dishonest and immoral on top of it, right? This is what we have to build on, right? Same thing with police officers. As bad of a rap they get, let's be honest, almost all of them are fine, right? They're there tough to job. Do a job.
Got to be a tough job, man.
Yeah, but at the same thing, they're not going to risk their pension and their health care and everything else that they got lined up by playing by the rules just to shake you down for $50 when they pull you over because, you know, they need a sandwich. And that happened to me when I was in Moscow, by the way.
Right? I was about to say this happens in Russia all the time. I know firsthand.
Yeah. So, you know, why does it happen there? Because I don't know now. I mean, this is 20 years ago. But at the time, these guys were getting paid nothing, literally. They were, you know, waiting for their back pay and all that sort of thing. So it's almost expected that they're going to shake you down for a bribe just so that they can, you know, put food on the table.
The scenario that I was given, just to kind of elucidate that. I had a friend whose father, who grew up in Russia, and father was prominent even in Russian, I won't say politics, but close enough. And they got pulled over on a family trip. And while they were pulled over, the police officer was explaining about his family situation and his sick daughter and how his wife wasn't doing not well and everything. And I remember my friend was sitting in the back seat thinking, why is this guy telling us all this stuff? This is odd. And my father hands him like $50 or $100 or whatever, you know, just money. And he's like, oh, you guys just have such a nice day. You know what I mean?
So yeah, that was so the negotiating.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, maybe they are being honest, you know, maybe not. Yeah. But, you know, it's just kind of expected. That's what I've learned. And this is a story I've heard from more than one person. Yeah. There's a fundamental lack of trust, though, in that, and the structure's not set to support it. So there's a minimum viable kind of amount of money that people need to make. They need to be sound and secure in their job, set schedule. And a lot of people will thrive in that environment. A lot of people want that.
Yeah. Yeah. That means it's called being normal.
Right. I never wanted that, but I'm not.
Yeah. I mean, you know. Neither one of us are quite right there, son.
That's why we're here. Yeah. I keep coming back to it, right? So if we have to make it more about what's – I'm not a utilitarian at all.
Yeah.
But I think the refined points of John Stuart Mill on Bentham's original expose – have some valid arguments in the traditional form of applied liberalism. And I'm not sure that, like, I'm just looking at it. If we come back and we look at the education system, right? Is it in the best interest of 10 people that we have a woke education system? Or is it in the best interest of 100 people, actually, that even the 10 that don't know it, that we actually teach them how to think and not what to think.
Yeah.
Right? So, and from that lens, it makes complete sense to me. You know? I think that the most common thing that I see happen in these arguments are that people apply the wrong level of abstraction to the problem. Mm. Okay? And they make it about their narrow biased viewpoint instead of looking at as much of the picture as they can to understand what the end product or result should be and then how we get to where we're going to get.
Yeah, I think you nailed it with that. I think that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. So that's where we need to go. And I'm just – this is all organic, by the way. I don't start the conversation with the end of the conversation, you know? Sorry. My – dear friend was calling to make sure I'm still alive, which is very kind given my current disposition. I'll save that for another future episode. The point that I was making is we don't come into these conversations knowing the outcome or the answer. But I do think that we're onto something there. And I think The other part of this that I want to correlate to is it's okay to fail. It's not okay to fail for a long period of time. Okay. So here's what I mean by that. If we fail quickly, that means that we realize that the path that we're going down is not correct, or it's not exactly recover. What we thought it was, and we can change our course. We change our direction. We use some degree of empiricism, hopefully, in that. And then we move forward, right? And I could get into this conversation about any number of topics, but apply that same approach to policy and life. And I wrote about this in an essay, like I said, probably a month ago. And the fact that we aren't doing that at scale and that we aren't willing to fail quickly, and you have to do this in business. If you don't do this in business, you're going to fail permanently.
Right.
Right? And it just doesn't make sense to me. So why don't we apply the same approach to government policy? And
because in business, you have a direct and immediate consequence in terms of finances.
Oh, look at
as
that.
As to whether or not your failure or success matters.
But
in the education world, there is no immediate consequence, right?
Even in the political world.
Or the political world, right? Yes. It's the same thing. It's the faux academic, elitist viewpoint of, no, you know, we're smart. We can talk about this and we can talk about this and we can talk about this. That's great. Do something. Act. Don't just talk. And, you know, what's the classic political maneuver? And it happens in all the education discussions too. Well, we'll form a committee to study it. We'll fund it for next semester or next year. The budget.
It furthers their own existence.
Right. And that's it. It's the virus perpetuating itself. And, you know, the virus can be supported as long as the host is healthy, but the host is ailing currently. And this permanent discussion mindset of talk and not act is going to be the death knell of our society. We're seeing it. And I hope that enough people will wake up and do something about it, either personally and privately or in, you know, public forum. But I'm very pessimistic about being able to change anything in our political structure. I think the best attitude is to adopt as a subversive and just say, okay, I've got to, you know, live in the world, but be not part of it, if I may quote somebody better than I in these regards.
It used to be my philosophy when I was younger.
Yeah. But I think we have to take that to heart because, you know, things, they ain't going too well. And
I wonder, we
have to realize society is separate from, you know, politics and institutions.
Indeed. What if, and this is something I've been pondering, and I don't have the answer. I don't have the answer yet, and I may never have the answer. Who knows? But do you think that having multiple political parties would put more pressure on the depolarization of typical political structure and the underlying entities that they represent?
So the student of democracy in me says yes, but the cynic says no, because it's going to be the same amount of money involved. It's just going to be carved up differently. So instead of, you know, two parties getting 50% each of the political dollar, it'll be 10 parties getting 10%. But the same dollar is getting doled out by the same hand behind the scenes. So if he ends up buying five parties instead of out of the 10, he's still at a 50% control rate, right?
Mm-hmm.
I am afraid that will be the result, regardless of whether or not we have two parties or 200.
And the structure, it seems, might be more, and this is something I've thought about extensively as well. If the points of capture are more, but you make an interesting economic point, it's I just have to buy different people in different situations, not so it's probably an equal amount of money or maybe plus a little bit, but that's what it is. It becomes an economic problem for control of a certain percentage of something,
well,
right? In this case,
we've talked about it in the past. What did Soros do to extend his control over the U.S.? He just bought district attorneys and mayors cheap, right? You know, what do you spend for a mayoral race in a major city to get, you know, your guy in your pocket? $1 million? What's a senator going to cost you? U.S. senator, 20 million? Yeah. I'd rather spend, you know, the money and get 20 mayors in 20 significant states and have them do my bidding You know, I spread out my influence more, and it's a better bang on the buck return.
Right. It's a very interesting way to think about it. I don't think it's a wrong way to think about it at all. It's just not how we're, I don't think we're wired based on what we're taught and what we see.
Yeah.
Think about it that way. But everything is economic at the end of the day. It really is.
Well, but I think, you know, you bring up a good point in that, you know, we've been conditioned in this country for too long to, you know, believe this whole godmom and apple pie garbage that they fed to us in grade school, right? Anybody can be president. Your elected officials listen to you. Your vote matters. It's all nonsense, right? Nothing that we do is going to affect anything if there isn't economic heft in back of it. So, you know, vote with your pocketbook, man. Don't give money to people who hate you.
That's probably that's some of the better advice I've heard in a long time. Don't give money to people who hate you. It means you'd have to pay attention. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's hard. Precisely.
So, yeah, I don't know how we get, I don't know how we get beyond that. I think we could restructure the laws about donations and disclosures of donations, you know, I think.
So then it just goes to soft money, right? You know, nothing's going to theoretically stop you or I from buying our own political ads to advocate a position, bar in the mind that we're broke, right? You know, we don't have.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, I don't know about you. I can't spend $100,000 on a TV ad to tell people, you know, what I think. In certain realms, that's short money. So why wouldn't I do it? Right.
Yeah. I don't know, but. Well, you'd have to want accountability first. I think that has to come there. So without wanting accountability, I don't know that we get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, and I mean, at a mass level, it's very difficult to get there to even enforce or enact this if we're not willing to hold people accountable for it in the first place. Well, we haven't.
Look, what's holding back from people demanding that accountability? It's the struggles of putting food on the table. I mean,
but you're 100% right. Right. We don't have the time.
Yeah. And I mean, even, you know, we doing the podcast, it's a luxury. How many people have, you know, proportionately speaking, the free time and the ability to do this, right? Where, you know, we spend however many hours a week, month, whatever, doing it versus, you know, some poor guy that comes home dead tired because he's been in a bucket truck all day in the freezing cold, you know, fixing, you know, power lines for us, right? Yeah, that dude wants to go home, eat, you know, maybe have a drink and then go to sleep. He can't worry about this stuff. He's got, you know, much more pressing concerns.
For sure.
And I think they're relying on this as an instrument of control.
I want to pick that up in a future episode because there are a lot of very hardworking people who have had a very difficult life that choose to make the best of it.
Right.
I've talked to several.
And I
would love to kind of share some of those stories in a future episode, actually, but it lends itself into this conversation. And I don't know if we can get, I don't know. I just think there are a lot of very hardworking people in this country and they are exhausted and they have to, what do you want to focus on? Would you rather focus on the time with your family and your children or the mass problems of the state? And the answer is it has to be somewhere in between, but we have to be willing to pay more attention to it. The less we pay attention to what's going on around us, the more likely we are going to be enslaved by what's going on around us.
Right.
So I think there's a fine line. It's that double-edged sword that you're talking about. And if you walk too far to the left, you get cut. You walk too far to the right, you get cut. You got to stay right in the middle.
Exactly. And
I think I'll leave us with that. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniel.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Subscribe now to be notified of future episodes and check out our website at theallunknowing.com.